Welcome to the Midland Seventh-day Adventist Church. We hope our broadcast will bless you.
Metamorphosis. Big word. Some of our little kids didn't know what it meant, I don't think. But it's an important word both in nature and in the spiritual realm. Webster defines it as a change of form, structure, or substance. This a more general definition. It could be a striking alteration in appearance. And in zoology, it's the change that occurs at various stages in the lives of certain creatures, like moths and butterflies, tadpoles going to frogs or toads. We've watched metamorphosis occur. And we find it amazing. We find it almost unbelievable. When I was a boy, I liked to collect insects, and particularly moths and butterflies. And I found that one of the best ways to get perfect specimens of the largest of the moths in particular, butterflies you could sometimes get otherwise, but moths, it was very difficult to get perfect specimens of the very large moths, except for one thing. If you could find the cocoon or the chrysalis and take it in and then be there when the moth emerged, you had usually a perfect specimen. My grandfather Dunlap lived down north of Battle Creek in the glacial moraine area, where there were many little ponds at the foot of little hills. And in the wintertime, we boys, my cousins and myself, used to like to go ice skating on those ponds. And we discovered that some of the ponds had little shrubs that grew in them. And if you looked hard, you might be able to find a chrysalis, or a cocoon, actually, in those shrubs. And those cocoons would be, almost the size of a baseball. And they were the chrysalis for the Cecropia moth. A fairly uncommon moth, and one that is very beautiful and very desirable to have in one's collection. So I used to enjoy hunting for these chrysalises in order to get a Cecropia moth. Wonderful colors, subtle beauty, and if you look at the worm that it comes from, you would never guess that such beauty would be the last stage in the life cycle of that little creature. Metamorphosis, change, unexpected change, radical change, change that is almost beyond belief, and yet it occurs. As we come into springtime, we look forward to changes that are likewise radical and almost unbelievable, to go from bare trees to trees that are covered with lush green growth, to go from barren ground to ground covered with green grass, to forest floors that have beautiful spring flowers growing in them. Springtime is just a wonderful time of year, time for new life, seemingly just to burst up everywhere. And the changes that occur in springtime provide us with spiritual lessons as well. Spiritual lessons about change. Birth and rebirth. Creation, recreation. The resurrection, translation. As we think of these wonderful spiritual events in our mind, we should be drawn to the one who makes these changes possible, the one who is our creator and who is our recreator. And that will be our focus this morning, the creator. The German philosopher Gottfried Leibniz asked perhaps the most basic of all questions. Why is there something instead of nothing? Ever think of that? Without something or someone doing something, there would just be nothing. Emptiness, nothing. Maybe not even empty space. Just nothing at all. And so how did there get to be something where there was nothing? Well, we who believe the Bible would say a creator was active. A creator who liked to have things, who liked to have creatures, who liked to have beings, liked to have worship, liked to have praise, liked to have interaction. He was the one that was responsible for making something where before there was nothing. And we could cite Bible texts that support that idea. For us as Seventh-day Adventists, everything we believe is rooted in the reality of a creator. God as our creator. Think about how creation relates to the beliefs that we have. Almost all of our beliefs relate back to the Creator. We find about God's nature by looking at His creation. We learn about His love as a result of creation. The great controversy is intertwined with creation. The fall. There wouldn't have been a fall if there had not been creation. There would not have been sin if man had not been created on this earth. And we learn about forgiveness and redemption and Christ's death on the cross as it relates to the Creator. Because only one who is the Creator, the originator, is able to bring back what was lost as a result of sin. And we could go through each of these beliefs seeing how it relates back to the Creator. But there is one belief above all others that relates to that, and that is the belief regarding the Sabbath, the seventh-day Sabbath, the memorial of creation. The Sabbath is the most basic symbol of the most basic teaching. The only thing more fundamental than the Sabbath is God. Hence, to usurp the Sabbath, the seventh-day Sabbath, is to usurp the Lord's authority at the most basic possible level, that of Him as Creator. It's to get behind everything and uproot it at the core. It is indeed to seek to take the place of God Himself. And so the Sabbath is tied to this concept of creation in ways that are profound and deep. The Sabbath is embedded in the creation count. Today, the creation account is questioned by many people. Even many Christians don't believe in the account of creation as it's presented there in Genesis 1 and 2. Many attempt to find a way to correlate scientific findings with the Bible story, ways to somehow change what we believe about Genesis 1 and 2 to make it agree with the evolutionary concepts that are being discovered by science. And this is a challenging area. One such attempt is what is called theistic evolution, which is to say that God used evolution and long periods of time to arrive at what we have in the world today. That there was a creator God, but He did not create in the special creation described in Genesis 1. Is this an acceptable approach? At least, to my way of thinking, it has some major problems. And one of these problems is the issue of death. Evolution is built around the idea that Darwin forwarded of survival of the fittest. in order for the fittest to survive, the less fit have to die. And so evolution is built on the concept that selective life and selective death gets us to a higher state. And yet, when we read the Bible, the description there of the Garden of Eden, we don't find death described. We find that even the animals that we might think of as being carnivorous today were given a vegetarian diet. They did not eat other animals in order to survive. They ate plants. And the first death we have hinted at in the Bible is the death of the animals that provided the skins to clothe Adam and Eve after they fell, after they sinned. And so evolution and the Genesis account create some major problems, some major disconnects. Today we are separated from that perfect Garden of Eden by two massive events. First was sin, and we don't know the consequences of sin entirely. The Bible gives us some hints that things changed in the environment after sin came. And there was a need to keep people out of the Garden of Eden after sin came, because the Garden of Eden was being preserved as a place where sin had not had its influence. Of course, Ellen White suggests that at the time of the flood, the Garden of Eden was taken from this earth and is now being maintained by God in heaven, and that eventually that garden will again be on this earth and we will be able to see and enjoy it. Another major event that keeps us from knowing what that garden was like is the flood. The Genesis flood, the universal flood that has changed forever the surface of our earth. And we think of floods like we have here in Midland, where the water comes up and the water goes down and most everything is the way it was, except for maybe a little bit of sediment where there wasn't sediment and the leaves are dirty in the forest where the water's overflowed. But that isn't anything like the Genesis flood. The Genesis flood was a catastrophe beyond any catastrophe that we can imagine, enveloping the whole earth. If we look at the evidence of it, we see the geological column, we see the fossil record, we see the fossil fuels that are buried under the earth, and the quantities of these things, the extent of what was done is just almost beyond comprehension. It's certainly beyond anything we can put together as a model to say this is the way it was and the result was what we see today. No one has come up with a model that really acceptably describes the events that occurred during the flood. Fossil fuels on our earth, we worry about running out of oil, but that's debatable. But even beyond oil, there's a tremendous supply of fossil fuels of other forms. Coal, enough coal for several hundred years. And beyond coal is oil shale. And there's much, much more oil shale than there is coal. And then there are tar sands, a new source of fossil oil, or fossil fuel, specifically oil, where the oil is mixed with sand. And large parts of Alberta are covered with tar sands for hundreds of feet deep, waiting to be processed and turned into oil. And at $60 a barrel, you can make tar sands into oil economically. And then there's the methane gas that's a byproduct of these other fossil fuels that is in many places in the world. And one of the interesting things about the fossil fuels is that they occur from pole to pole. There doesn't seem to be any place where some are not available, at least within one kind or another, without going too far. And if we look at the geological column, we find that the sediments or the rocks that make up the geological column are sedimentary rocks. That is, they were rocks that formed by various kinds of soil coming out of settling through water and under pressure changing into the rocks that exist today. So the geological column is evidence of water covering the earth. And if we look at the fossils contained in those, that geological column, at least the larger fossils of larger creatures, in almost every case, it appears that the creature died a violent death. It was not just a natural death at the end of their normal lifespan. We find the full distribution of the various ages for animals in the geological column, in the fossils, not just the old adults that we would expect if death in fossils occurred as a result of the normal aging process. It's like a catastrophe occurred, the whole population was killed all at once, they were buried, and they were turned to fossils. So you have the early stages, the middle stages, and the late stages of life for all the creatures represented in the column. So there is a lot of evidence for the flood, but can we go back and say, based on that this is the way creation occurred? The answer is no. So how do we get at the issue of, was there a special creation? Was there a creation, or did it just happen? With the advent of molecular biology, we're advancing to a new frontier in scientific understanding of how life works. We won't go into this in detail, but this is what's called a ribosome. It's a molecule that, for those of you with a little chemistry knowledge, is a very large molecule. The molecular weight would be around 4 million. It would be comprised of somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million individual atoms. And the location of all those atoms has been determined using cryogenic X-ray crystallography, so that a map of this molecule has been developed. An amazing molecule. And you say, well, it looks like a bunch of tangled up string there. Yes, it does. So I've got a simpler version of it so that we can start to understand a little bit about what's involved with this molecule. Here's the same thing. This is a marvelous molecular machine. By the way, the ribosome is present in every cell in our body. In fact, a typical cell may have 1 million ribosomes in it, 1 million of those molecules floating around in it, doing their work. This is the machine that makes proteins. A marvelous machine. How are proteins made? Well, proteins are a polymer, a large molecule made up of individual pieces called amino acids. There are about 20 different amino acids that go to make any of the proteins in our body. And in our body, we've got at least 10,000 different proteins. The recipe for the protein comes from the DNA in the nucleus of the cell. All the different proteins are encoded in the DNA, in the genes. Each gene has one particular recipe, and that recipe is for one particular protein. But the DNA has to stay in the nucleus. So in order to make the protein, you need a way to transfer the recipe from the nucleus, from the DNA, out into the cell where the ribosome is located. And that's done by what we call messenger RNA. You see the mRNA down in the lower right? Well, that is a long string molecule, and you only see a little tiny piece of it there. It would be, it would wrap around this church building many times if we were to stretch it out at this scale. The messenger RNA takes the recipe for the protein that's contained in the DNA and brings it out to the ribosome so it can be used. And this ribosome is a chemical factory that is designed to make proteins. The protein, in this case, is what's called the growing peptide chain. You see it up there at the top? And it's only got three units at this point, the green one, the brown one, and the yellow one. And there's a blue one that's going to be attached to that chain in the next step. The chain will be hundreds of amino acids long when it's finished. So each three units down on the messenger RNA are a code which tells this machine, the ribosome, which amino acid to put on next. And the tRNA, the transferase RNA, is what brings the next protein or the next amino acid in, and it has to fit with the code there at the bottom, the codon. or else it can't be used. And so this messenger RNA has the code for all 20 of the amino acids that will be used in the protein chain, and as the chain is formed at the top, the messenger RNA moves through the molecule in a long string, and out from another part of the molecule comes this long string of the polypeptide, the protein. And this machine is there working day and night, one of a million similar machines in every cell in your body. Quite a marvelous operation. And this is very recent information that's been developed to understand how this works. Some people say that the RNA or the DNA and all of this is just happenstance. Others, creationists, say that it's evidence for an intelligent design. The problem that the evolutionists have with intelligent design theory is that they say it depends on a supernatural outside force in order for it to work, and they don't want to believe that any outside such force is necessary in order for life to exist. Well, they've got some problems on their hands, but they think they're making progress, and they accuse the creationists of not giving them enough time to get it all sorted out. And it is interesting that if you go into a study of the genes and the DNA that exist in every organism, you can find evidence for change in those structures and the development of different things as time goes by. So the evolutionist says, aha, we have a chemical understanding of how evolution actually occurs. This shouldn't surprise us who are creationists, because if we've looked around, we see that microevolution does occur. Species do change their form. They develop new traits, lose other traits. And if you go to the DNA, you can actually see it spelled out in the recipes, that some of the genes are no longer functional, that different genes have taken over, so that now the species has some different characteristics. This is microevolution, demonstrable, visible. But the evolutionist extrapolates from microevolution to macroevolution and says because it works on the micro scale, it works on the macro scale, where you're going from a one-celled organism to a multicelled organism, from one species to a totally different species. As best I can understand and observe, that has not been demonstrated in the record. And it's also noteworthy that a different explanation would give you the same answer, would fit the same data, namely that a creator God who had a pattern that he was going to use, used it over and over very effectively. Why else do you think that all creatures have DNA in them and all plants have DNA in them? It works. It's the way he did it. And that fact can be used to argue for evolution or for creation. Unfortunately, it doesn't limit the argument to only one answer. Well, what does the Bible say about this? We're obviously challenged in this day and time regarding the question of evolution and the question of creation. And if creation is under question, the Sabbath is also under attack. If you do a study of the book of Revelation and look for references to the Creator, you observe an interesting thing. And these are the four places in Revelation where creation or the Creator is mentioned. And let's look at them individually and see where they fit into the scenario that the book of Revelation gives us and the chronology in the book of Revelation. First one is Revelation 3:14, where the person giving the message to the Laodicean church is introduced as the Amen, the beginning of the creation of God. In other words, the Creator is the one who has a message for the Laodicean church. The other six churches that come before Laodicea, other characteristics are attributed to the God, the messenger. But only in the last church is the Creator God alluded to. So it says that understanding God to be the Creator is important for the Laodicean church, and the Laodicean church is representative of the church at the end of time. In Revelation 4:11, we find an allusion to God as the Creator, And this is in a section where praise is being given to God. It's not possible to connect a specific time to that event, but clearly the heavenly beings recognize the importance of worshiping God as the Creator at all times. Revelation 10, 5, and 6, we find a mighty being described as an angel, who could be a messenger, could be God, who is about to make a proclamation. He swears by him that liveth forever and ever, who created heaven and the earth and the sea, and he swears that there shall be time no longer. A very profound statement, one that we puzzle over a little bit. What does it mean that there shall be time no longer? Well, clearly it has something to do with the time of the end, when time will run out. And it is at this time that this proclamation is made, and the proclamation includes the fact that this is the Creator who is behind this proclamation. And finally, Revelation 14, 6 and 7, the first angel's message, where we read, "Fear God and give glory to Him, for the hour of His judgment has come. Worship Him that made heaven and earth and the sea and the fountains of waters." At the end of the world, there's a judgment to occur, and it's at that same time when this message is proclaimed that we are told we should be worshiping God as the Creator. And to worship God as Creator suggests we should be keeping the day that's the memorial of creation, the Sabbath day. The debate continues over creation and evolution, and I think it will continue right to the end. Does it make a difference for us whether we agree or disagree with the creation account? I would say that for Adventists, creation is an imperative. The answer is yes to that question. We must recognize creation. Yes, 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 as loud as you want to proclaim it. Creation and the Creator God are important to us. If we ignore it, we do so at our peril. We've seen that the Bible, the writer of Revelation, given the message by God, anticipated that there would be attack on the concept of God as Creator in the end time. And he put messages there so that we would be reminded at this particular time that it's important to worship God as Creator. In this time also, we find that the Bible tells us about metamorphosis. There is a change coming. You know, one of the characteristics of those in the world at the end of time, according to Peter, the writer Peter, is that they mock this idea that there's to be change. But the Bible gives us a picture of metamorphosis change, metamorphic scale changes, things that are going to be changed beyond our belief that such change would be possible, in the same way that the cecropia worm becomes the beautiful moth. Those kind of changes are destined for this world. It's not going to be business as usual, status quo, nothing new. There are going to be new things, and the Bible brings this out. Because of sin, we need a clean heart. We need to be changed. David recognized this in the Psalm. Revelation promises that God will make all things new. 1 Corinthians 15, talking about the changes that will occur at the second coming, they'll occur in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye. And Paul also writes, "Eye hath not seen, nor ear heard, neither hath entered in the heart of man the things which God hath prepared for them that love him." There are changes coming, important changes that we want to be ready for. We need to realize that sin has affected all of creation. And Paul brings this out in Romans 8, where he talks about the fact that all of creation is suffering as a result of man's sin. And I like the way this version puts it. "The whole creation is on tiptoe to see the wonderful sight of the sons of God coming into their own." In other words, human beings going back to what God wanted them to be. And the hope is that in the end, the whole of created life will be rescued from the tyranny of change and decay. Notice that change. A lot of the change that occurs as a result of the evolutionary process is negative change. And I attended a lecture recently about the adaptation, the survival of the fittest, studied at the level of the genes. And what I came away with was the realization that this ability to be changed, to adapt, is not unlimited. It has an end. And as you undergo change, you give up the ability to change back to what you were. You can't get back to where you started from. And it's in the genes. You're degrading. You aren't getting better. You may adapt to a particular situation, but it's going to have other effects, shorter lifespan, more susceptibility to disease, and so on. It's interesting that the gene that causes sickle cell anemia is also a gene that helps the person with sickle cell anemia avoid malaria. So which would you rather have, a malaria or sickle cell anemia? Neither one a very good choice. But the sickle cell anemia gene survived because not getting malaria in the area where that's a common problem was a survival advantage. It didn't mean you had a better life. It just meant that you didn't die of malaria. And so the changes that come about as a result of adaptation are really decay. And as the last line indicates, at the present time, all created life groans in a sort of universal travail, universal pain, waiting for birth, waiting for something better, something new to be delivered. Talked to a theologian about this text recently and asked the question, what is being talked about where it says all of creation? Is it talking just about this earth? Or is it talking about things that are beyond this earth? And the answer is we can't tell for sure from the text. The idea that the recreation is to extend beyond this earth is not excluded by what's written in this, by Paul here. And you say, well, only this world has been touched by sin. Not so. Heaven was touched by sin. Sin originated in heaven. So when God recreates to get rid of the sin problem, is he going to recreate heaven as well? And what about the universe in between? I've always been puzzled by the second law of thermodynamics that says that things continue to run down. Why are there stars out there that are dying? Was that part of God's original plan? I don't know the answer to that. But maybe we should think a little bit beyond just this world and the effect that sin has had. Maybe it's affected things way out there. And they too are groaning, hoping for the change. In Genesis, the idea was presented that Adam and Eve would be the caretakers for the earth, the stewards of the earth, the proprietors of the earth, the ones responsible for the earth staying a good place to live. We have pretty well lost that vision today, I'm afraid. And I would ask the question, those of us who believe in creation, who believe in God as a creator, what are the practical implications for us today of believing in a creator? We could spend time on this, much time thinking about it. And I'm not here to say that we should all agree on all of these things, but we should have an opinion. We should have a position based on our relationship with God and our belief in him as the creator. What about the sanctity of life? What about abortion? What about racial diversity, sexual diversity, educational diversity? Is this good or bad? How do we deal with that in our world? It's here. What about the environment? What about global warming? Is that something we should be concerned about? Stewardship of the entire earth. I like that little phrase, think globally, act locally. In other words, do things yourself that will help to avoid a global catastrophe. And what about war? What should be our position on that? In the past, I don't know that I've ever heard it expressed, but I've gotten the impression that we, as Adventists, say, well, the second coming is going to happen right away. It's going to take care of all these problems, so we don't have to worry about this stuff. Is that an adequate answer? Is the second coming the solution that excuses us from responsibility in the here and now? I don't think so. In fact, I would suggest that the book of Revelation warns us about that kind of an attitude. You perhaps have read this verse there almost in the middle of the book, toward the end of chapter 11, where praise is being given to God Almighty at a certain point in time. And that point in time is now, I think. We see it described there, the nations were angry. God's wrath has come, the time of the dead, that they should be judged, the time of the end time judgment, and the time for the reward to be given to God's servants. And it goes on to enumerate the prophets and all of those who love the Lord. And at the same time, God is about to destroy them which destroy the earth. It's only in the last 50 or 75 years that humankind has acquired the ability to really destroy the earth. We have it well within our means now to destroy the earth to the point where it would be uninhabitable for a long, long period of time. And, of course, we think immediately of nuclear annihilation, a nuclear winter. But we have other ways that we can do it as well. And global warming is one of those ways. We can also do it through messing up the food supply with contamination. Global warming probably wouldn't exterminate life on this earth for a fairly long period of time, but if we continue to contaminate our food supply, it could happen much quicker. And so the destruction of this earth is at hand. God says, I'm not going to let this happen. I'm going to come before it happens, but it's not going to be good for those who don't take care of the earth. We, each one, have a responsibility for that. And so our loyalty to the Creator comes back to the Sabbath, comes back to a belief in special creation, comes back to a belief that He really does love us, that He sent His Son to rescue us from the problem that we could otherwise not escape, the problem of sin. And we have a wonderful opportunity to worship Him from week to week on the day that memorializes His creative act. And loyalty to God is not just nothing. It's not just doing nothing. It has specific things that we need to respond to and do. Like loving God means that we keep His commandments, that we do worship Him as the Creator on the day that He has designated for this. I like the way the Message Bible presents this. The Message is a translation of the Bible into contemporary English language. The proof that we love God comes when we keep His commandments. The saints stand patiently, passionately patient, keeping the commands of God, staying faithful to Jesus. These are the way God characterizes His people in the end time. I hope the description fits us. We are called Christians. Revelation, in several places, talks about God's name and His name being attached to His people. In this verse, they shall see His face and His name shall be in their forehead. That doesn't mean painted on the outside. That means inside the frontal lobe where our actions, where our decisions are made, where our reactions to what comes upon us are sorted out. If His name is written in our foreheads, we will act according to the ways that He would have us to act. As we face these difficult issues, we do well to ask the question that has become a cliche with some, what would Jesus do? What would Jesus do if he lived on our street? What would Jesus do if he saw the problems in our world? If he attended our church? If he taught a Sabbath school class? What would Jesus do? And what should we do in order to be like Jesus? Because Jesus is the Creator, I can have assurance that he is also the Recreator. We have no hope for the future except for the resurrection. Christ's resurrection was the first demonstration of this, and we can look to that as a demonstration of what can happen to us if we were to die. But also we can look forward to translation and eternal life, the perfect life that God originally intended human beings to experience in the garden. The Message puts it this way, Jesus speaking, "Don't fear, I am first, I am last, I'm alive. I died, but I came to life, and my life is now forever. See these keys in my hand? They open and lock death's door. They open and lock hell's gates." What a Lord. What a Savior. What a Creator. Let us worship Him.
You have been listening to the broadcast from the Midland Seventh-day Adventist Church at 2420 East Ashman in Midland, Michigan. If you are in the area, we cordially invite you to visit our church Saturday mornings. If you are a distance away, we encourage you to continue visiting our website and weekly podcast at midlandsda.org.